Welcome to Maximus Live episode 54. Thanks to folks joining us on Discord. I see Diego Nabs in the audience. Thanks everyone joining us on Twitter Spaces, YouTube Live, and all the folks that are trickling in on Clubhouse. If you want to raise your hand and join the conversation, please do. For those who are not familiar, my name is Dr. Cam. I am a licensed clinical psychologist and professor of psychiatry at a medical school. And I am also the CEO of Maximus. Maximus is my company. You can check us out at MaximusTribe.com. We focus on men's hormone optimization in terms of increasing testosterone through a very safe and effective prescription medication and hormonal vitamin supplement, along with health coaching. And that's actually the theme of today's show. I'm happy to talk about health and performance optimization. If you have any New Year's resolutions that you're working on and you want a little bit of coaching in terms of how to achieve it, whether it comes to nutrition, exercise, sleep, focus, or relationships and intimacy, I cover all of those topics, including in my ebook, Maximize Your Testosterone, which you can download from our website at MaximusTribe.com. So we always like to start each week with a weekly unpopular opinion, and then I'll take questions from the audience. So be sure to raise your hand if you want to ask me anything or be coached through anything. So this week's unpopular opinion is that health optimization does not require being a biohacker or being over the top. And this was kind of inspired by a video that I watched this week by Brian Johnson. And I'll caveat this and say that I really like Brian. I think he's a very bright individual. He sold his company Braintree for $800 million, runs other companies and an investment fund. Very sharp individual. He posted a video on YouTube about his morning routine. It's a 30-minute video. You can go check it out on YouTube about. And he has a ton of money and a whole team of scientific experts to optimize his health and reverse aging that he does. So I was pretty interested as someone who works in this category to see, okay, if you're like basically Bruce Wayne, billionaire, and you have all the resources and experts at your disposal, what the heck are you doing in terms of your routine? So this guy goes to bed at 8:30 p.m. and he talks about basically how he's missing out on a lot of social functions, but he thinks it's kind of worth it to him because it helps apparently optimize his sleep. And then he also follows, what was interesting, he was talking about a supplement routine and how he, supplements iron, because he's iron deficient. And I was kind of curious. I was like, why is this guy iron deficient? In fact, most men have too much iron and are typically trying to dump, their excess iron. And the reason is because he's on a vegan diet, where he doesn't eat meat. And, even though you can get iron from plants, it's not the best form. The best form of iron, the most bioavailable form, is called heme iron, and you can only get it from meat, especially red meat, that he's not consuming. And so the funny thing is I actually sent him a message on Twitter, and I was like, you know, if you're trying to be really scientific, if your diet essentially is deficient in iron and you have to supplement it, because otherwise, like, you know, 50 years ago when there was no iron supplements, nobody essentially could follow a vegan diet without creating a significant nutritional deficiency. Doesn't that suggest that your diet is not really optimal? And it kind of blew my mind because I was like, this guy's very smart. He has nutritionists, doctors, I'm sure, et cetera, on his team. And he's looking, he's like, oh, I don't know, I look good. All my blood values are really good. This must mean I'm doing the right thing. And the thing is, look, generally he is in pretty good health. I think anyone who's obsessed with their health, for the most part, unless they're doing a lot of drugs or alcohol, is probably, whatever they're doing is probably better than nothing. And it's certainly better than the standard American diet. And the interesting part of the video, by the way, he was talking about, you know, when I was a kid, I drank skim milk and Cocoa Pebbles. And it makes me cringe that, you know, I thought that was okay back in the day. And he's like, well, maybe, I don't know, in 20 years, I'll think the same thing about my current diet. And I was like, yeah, that's actually the point, in the sense that, you know, it's very easy when you're a smart person and you're surrounded by smart people to be absolutely convinced that you're doing the right thing and that you're never wrong, right? And even when people try to give you feedback, and I have in the past, by the way, and been like, you know, I'm not sure some of your assumptions are correct. That certainly I don't believe a vegan diet is superior. In fact, it's clearly inferior if you look at the scientific evidence. Like, by definition, something that is deficient in iron and B12 and you can't survive on it without taking a exogenous or external supplement is an inferior diet. But if you're convinced that you found the secret, you know, and you found a way to hack around it by obviously taking other stuff, kind of, you know, believe your own mythology, I would say. That's why, you know, I kind of tweeted, you know, this separate kind of thing, unrelated, but, you know, I think it's really important. I'm going to tell my son this for, you know, guidance. You know, no matter how rich, no matter how great technology you have, no matter how many smart advisors you have around them, you can't fall prey to your own ego and thinking that you have the answer. A really good scientist, a true scientist, basically will always admit when they're wrong. In fact, you have to be wrong, and you have to be constantly be willing to update your theories over time. And even though he kind of admitted that principle is true, he wasn't really practicing it by following this really extreme, quite frankly, routine that I don't think is very optimal. So it was a very interesting lesson in the sense of, like, you know, when you watch this and you think about sort of health optimization, you're like, I got to be this crazy, you know, a biohacker that goes to sleep at 8:30, shines these crazy devices in my face and eats nothing but plants. That's far from the case. As an interesting contrast to Brian, you know, a bodybuilder that I followed, Dorian Yates, who was the 6-time Mr. Olympia. Now, obviously, I don't advocate steroid use, which was part of his regimen. But the interesting lesson from Dorian Yates is this guy was the world's best bodybuilder for a very long period of time in the 1980s and 1990s. And he only worked out 4 times a week for an hour. Now, the workouts were very intense. Literally, he kind of coined the term high-intensity training. But this guy's only in the gym for 4 hours. And this guy's a professional bodybuilder that weighed over 300 pounds at this point. But it just goes to show that it was really about quality, not quantity. And 4 hours a week is actually what any amateur, quite frankly, does. And in fact, there's a lot of non-pro bodybuilders who work out much more with much poorer results. So it just goes to show, in my opinion, being great health does not have to require a lot of money, a lot of technology, a lot of effort, or a lot of time, or doing anything that's particularly extreme. You can get a lot of results in very little effort if you know the right things to do and follow the right routines, that where a little goes a long way. Like, just for instance, you know, getting up in the morning, taking a 10-minute walk to clear your head and get some sunshine in your eyes, very high ROI activity. So little things like that can actually make a huge difference in terms of your health. You don't need to be extreme. You don't need to do, you know, things that make you a social pariah in order to have optimal health. So just an interesting contrast and interesting lesson learned there in terms of health optimization. All right, with that said, happy to take questions from the audience. And if not, we have a bunch of questions from last week we can answer. And we'll invite some folks up to speak as well from Twitter. So if you have questions, Harrison, Dan, and I can't see who the third person is, feel free to ask. Or folks on Clubhouse, if you want to raise your hand and ask any questions about health optimization, happy to take any questions.
Hey, Dr. Cam. So can you hear me?
Yes, sir. How you doing, Harrison?
Great. I'm doing good. So I noticed that sometimes my symptoms, my testosterone symptoms, go back and forth. They're completely different depending on the week. Is there any explanations for why that would be? That be something related to nutrients or something related to dopamine levels or something like that?
What symptoms are you talking about here?
I'd say lack of erection stiffness. Probably like a little bit of a fogginess in my head, but probably, yeah, I'd say those are the major things. But it's very variable, which makes no sense. So my symptoms will be weird for a couple of weeks, and then it'll completely go away.
Have you noticed any contributing factors that you think may be contributing to that in terms of lifestyle?
I have a list. Yeah. So I used to think it could have something to do with my the amount of nutrients I'm taking.
Mm-hmm.
There's something wrong with my way I absorb nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong. I also think it might have to do with smoking. Sometimes I do smoke.
Yeah.
I think that could be contributing to it as well.
Yeah, for sure. So obviously, like, in terms of like damage to your body, like smoking is obviously not great, and it could be. It's hard to tell, because if you're talking about sort of like sexual function related symptoms, this is the trickiest actually of the symptoms, actually, I would argue, because sexual function, especially libido, referring to sort of like sexual drive, is really the most psychological, actually, I would argue, of all the symptoms, in the sense that higher testosterone does associate with greater or improved sexual function. Guys who have naturally higher or optimized testosterone, generally, like, the, for instance, the drug that we use as part of the Maximus King protocol, 75% of the time people report improvements in sexual function. So we know that increasing, for instance, someone's testosterone typically improves their sexual function. But it also means 25% of the time it doesn't. And the question is why? And that's because libido is psychological and environmental as well. So I'll give you some examples of this. So one of the biggest factors that influences, quite frankly, libido is stress. Stress and also, I would say, performance anxiety. So obviously, acutely in the situation, if you're not with sort of like a partner that you're comfortable with, a lot of times guys, because of the performance anxiety, that can obviously affect their libido and or their erectile quality.
Would you be able to rule out psychological if it's not with a partner? This would happen without even being with a partner.
Well, yeah. So my question to you is how's your stress levels?
Really bad. I mean, to be honest, not great.
So if that's the case, then, you know, I would definitely investigate that as a contributing factor. Now, we do know, obviously, stress levels do vary quite a bit, hour to hour, day to day, week to week. So if you notice that you obviously have a high amount of stress, and you notice that obviously your, you know, sexual function, ED, all that good stuff is varying, which is what you're reporting, there may be an association between the two. So one thing that you may want to do to see if, well, okay, this is an interesting hypothesis, is it true? You may want to track your stress levels and your symptoms. So generally, whenever I'm kind of like working with a client in my private practice, I'll be like, all right, this is an interesting thing you brought up. These are some potential hypotheses. Let's do a little experiment and test them. So you may want to, for the next week or so, just write down like your average stress levels every single day. Pretty easy, right? Like a 0 to 10 scale. How was my stress when I reflect upon it, you know, at the end of the day before I'm going to sleep? And then also notice, like, you know, rate your, you know, whatever symptoms that are concerning to you. So like, how was my sex drive or libido today, 0 to 10? And how is my ability to maintain, you know, my erectile strength and quality, 0 to 10? And then track that, I would say, at least for a week, if not two, and start to see if you start to notice patterns. Like, obviously, on the days where your stress levels are highest, if you're starting to notice, oh, that's when it's dipping, then, okay, now you're establishing a little bit more causality there. And if it's not, you're like, I don't know, the day I was the most stressed, it was actually the best. And that was happening consistently, not just on one day, but you find the opposite pattern to be true, then maybe we can rule out psychological factors. But I really think, you know, in this case, we want to almost do like an N of one experiment case study, if you will, where start to track your symptoms and also track your stress levels and see if you're noticing an association between the two.
Yeah, it's a great idea. I'm definitely going to start a log and, you know, I'll rate my stress levels. I'll even probably throw in a couple other factors. And that'd definitely be an interesting idea. That sounds great.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Do you take people in New York by any chance?
So in terms of are you talking about the company or the private practice?
Yeah, because I remember I was trying to set up some kind of appointment, and it said, yeah, you guys don't really take people in New York.
Not yet. So we're very, very close. In February we're gonna launch actually in New York. So if you can hold out for a few weeks. We're actually really excited to launch in New York. We're actually going to use a super, super cool way of actually measuring testosterone. It doesn't require pricking your fingers, which is sort of the standard way. It uses these tiny little micro needles you don't even feel. You just put a little device on your shoulder. It collects the blood. You don't even notice it, and you can mail it off to a lab. So it's really, really cutting edge. I'm really glad to debut it, and we're actually going to do that pilot in New York. So yeah, just hold on for a few weeks, and we'll be able to launch with you then. Yeah, the other thing I was going to ask you is, what do you think is contributing to your stress?
Well, I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing with my career. I'm pretty young, yeah. And so I've been seesawing a lot back and forth, and so there's a lot of uncertainty around that. Mm-hmm. And so that type of stress is very hard to eliminate. Although it's looking like I'm going to go into software engineering, and things are going to become a lot more. A lot less variable, and I'll be able to kind of relax a little bit. But I think that's definitely a huge contributing factor.
For sure. Well, I think it's very psychologically insightful for you to realize where your stress is coming from. That's actually better than most people. A lot of people are a little bit clueless. But, you know, it sounds like you kind of have a clear and present stressor, but it's not an unusual one. I think most young, early career people are going through that. If not, I know people, in their 30s and 40s who are still going through that because they're considering changing jobs, if not changing their careers, outright. So it's not unusual what you're feeling, and it's totally understandable why that's contributing to your stress. Because obviously, especially as a young male, our identities are often, unfortunately, tied very much to our occupations and our professional success. So one bit of advice that I have regarding this is, this is where I really think mentorship and support make a big difference, especially to young people. This is why I'm still a clinical professor at UCSF. And the reason I take my time out of my week to do that is because I like working with young students who are, they're training to be psychiatrists in this particular case. But, in addition to teaching them how to diagnose and treat patients, I also provide them with professional mentorship in terms of what is it like in the real world? What is it like to run a private practice? How do I get my first job? All these kinds of things. So that's actually why we created the community aspect of Maximus. If you haven't joined our Discord already, you can join at discord.maximustribe.com. It's actually free. So we obviously have our customers there, but we open it actually to the general public. And the whole thesis behind the Maximus Tribe, which is what we call our community, is that self-improvement is not meant to be done alone. We call it mutual improvement. And so one of the things that you'll find in the community, in addition to the coaching that we do, we have channels. So if you actually join us, there is, in fact, a professional channel on there. It's called, let me look it up, Professional in Finance. It's a little hashtag Professional in Finance. We actually have a bunch of software engineers who are part of our community. There's over 1,000 men that are on it. So it's a great place to ask, hey, man, I want to become a software engineer. What do I need to learn and do? Or I'm already on in track to learn it. How do I find my first position? And there's guys who are literally on there some people obviously are getting mentorship, but a lot of people like to give it. And there's a lot of folks, we have literally folks from 18-year-old college students all the way to New York hedge fund managers that are married and have 3 kids. And all they want to do is just give back. So I think in order to attenuate some of your stress, and some of that is natural existential angst that we all have, because you're like, well, what do I need to do? Am I going to make it? Talk to someone who's been there who can kind of mentor you. And the community is a really great way to connect with, it's including people in software engineering that can shine a little bit of light on that path that you want to take.
That's awesome. That's great. I appreciate that a lot. Now, I've got one last question for you, if you don't mind. It's about neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I remember hearing this somewhere. I don't remember where, and I don't know if it's accurate. So if it's outright wrong, just tell me. But I remember hearing that your brain is more plastic while you're young, and it becomes less plastic around the age of 25. Now, I'm diagnosed with low testosterone. Does that mean if I got onto testosterone, or if I raised my testosterone levels up, that it would somehow affect my brain development disproportionately higher if I did it earlier?
In terms of increasing neuroplasticity, is that the question?
Well, no, I know that, tell me if this is right or wrong, but that testosterone and estrogen play a role in brain development, right?
Right, yes.
So if I were to, I'm diagnosed with low testosterone.
Yeah.
And so if I were to have low testosterone, right,
mm-hmm.
and go through puberty, go into adulthood, whatever,
right.
become whatever age, I would never go through those changes. Now, would increasing, or I wouldn't go through them as much. Would introducing exogenous testosterone or taking clomidophene or whatever mm-hmm. whatever you guys prescribe, would that possibly have a better effect if done earlier
and
change
that?
You know what I'm asking? Am I being clear? Not really.
Yeah. It's a complicated question. Yeah. I mean, no, it's an interesting question, but it's a little bit of a hypothetical, so it's a little bit hard to answer. I mean, our practice, we don't work with anyone who's under 18, because it's just more complicated to work with someone who's still going through, their pubertal development. Now, hypothetically, right? So this is kind of a hypothetical question. Would it have changed things if you had taken it earlier? I mean, maybe, but it also has potential side effects too, in the sense that while you're still growing and your growth plates are still fusing, there's different effects. That's why generally exogenous hormonal supplementation is not actually recommended unless there's a really good reason. Now, obviously, if someone is stunted in their growth, they're not producing enough growth hormone and they're clinically, short, not just like regular short, but they're like, you know, below like the fifth percentile. They can, for instance, take exogenous, for instance, growth hormone to make sure that they're growing to an appropriate height. But that's really not commonly done, like unless there's a very strong like clinical justification for doing so. You don't typically see most people under the 18 engaging in hormonal, you know, optimization or adjustment unless it's very clinically needed. I think once you become an adult and you're like, okay, I've kind of grown, the spectrum of what you treat becomes a lot more broad, because at that point, you know, you're fully grown. Most of your brain development has sort of happened over time. And if you want to take it for, you know, optimization or performance enhancement reasons, you're an adult. You can make informed decisions about your own health and the balancing the risk reward profile. And so certainly, I think if you're talking about that kind of, you know, practice, then that's absolutely to be done in adults. I think like it's hard for a child or someone who's not 18 to really like, you know, make fully.
Sorry to interrupt. I don't mean like 18. So for example, I'm 23, right?
Yeah.
Now, I read something that I don't know if you're considered fully an adult until 25 or whatever. I'm sure it's not exact. But would let's say I raised my testosterone level right now, mm-hmm. as opposed to raising it at 28, would that have a disproportionately higher effect on brain development? Or would it make no difference?
I don't think there's a lot of research on the difference between 23 and 28. So first of all, I mean, you're fully formed at like 23. Most women sort of achieve their development around 18, and then men in terms of like about 21 in terms of their growth, like literally their height. Now, brain development can take a little bit longer up until like 25. I have heard an argument, for instance, actually in women about like, you know, women are obviously on hormonal birth control quite at young ages, right? Like into their teens. And the effect of that in terms of their brain is quite frankly unknown. We don't really know what the long-term effects of that, because it's hard to do sort of randomized control trials. But I would say in terms of, you know, for you and 23, I think it's a difference in terms of what you're taking. If you're taking testosterone replacement therapy, it may have effects in terms of, because it's shutting down sort of the top of the cascade of the hormones. When you take TRT, you're replacing your testosterone with external testosterone. And so gonadotropin-releasing hormone, pregnenolone, progesterone, these sort of neuroactive hormones that are produced get decreased. And so I generally don't think it's a good idea for young people to do TRT unless they absolutely need to be on it. Meaning their diagnosis, not just being low testosterone, but being primary hypogonadal, meaning that their testicles do not work and they cannot be stimulated to produce their own testicles. That's pretty rare. You only see that with someone who has like testicular injury, testicular cancer, like something, or like there's something that's fundamentally wrong with their testicles that they're not able to produce testosterone. If that's the case,
I'm the second.
Yeah, so you have what's called secondary hypogonadism, which is much more common. That's what probably most guys, in fact, that are young have, in the sense that testosterone levels are lower than their father's. In that case, you're able to produce testosterone, you're just not producing as much as you should. And that's usually because of a disconnect between sort of the brain and the gonadal axis, the testes. And so what we do, we actually prescribe N-clomiphene, which is different than the clomiphene that you mentioned. It's the pure isolated isomer from Clomid. What that does is it's an estrogen blocker. And so it blocks estrogen in certain places, including the brain. And that triggers the body to say, oh, my estrogen is low. How do I produce more estrogen? Well, estrogen comes from testosterone. And so it produces more of the GnRH, which stimulates LH and FSH production, and it stimulates your testes to produce more of its own natural testosterone. And so I would actually argue it's safer, theoretically, for brain development because you're not shutting down that natural cascade. So as I mentioned, when you take TRT, you're shutting down GnRH, pregnenolone, progesterone, the whole chain or the whole funnel of how testosterone is produced naturally. But when you take in clomiphene, it's actually stimulating more of your own natural production. It shouldn't decrease, and in fact, it increases GnRH, and it shouldn't decrease pregnenolone, progesterone, allopregnenolone, these sort of neuroactive hormones that are important for brain function. So I would actually argue, at least theoretically, there's not a lot of literature on this, but in turn, if you understand the mechanisms of how these two things work, enclomiphene or the protocol that we use is much safer essentially in young people. That's why our advisor, Dr. Jim Hotling, is a professor at University of Utah Medical School, basically argues like no one under 50 should be on TRT unless you absolutely have to be, especially for or anyone, quite frankly, who wants to maintain their fertility, meaning they want to have children in the future. Not a great idea to shut down your testicles and make them shrink and reduce your ability to produce sperm. And clomiphene actually has the opposite effect, maintains or increases testicular size, increases fertility. It's actually a fertility drug. Originally, that's what the FDA approval was in 1976. Women have commonly used it, and it's used very commonly off-label for men to increase testosterone and fertility. And as I mentioned, it shouldn't shut down sort of that cascade of hormones. And that's why guys as young as 18 can actually be on our protocol. And in fact, there are studies of men in their 20s who've been on this class of medication safely for years. As far as I know, there's not sort of been adverse effects in terms of cognitive function or psychological function that's been noted.
That's awesome to hear. All right, thanks for all the answers.
Absolutely.
Very interesting to hear this stuff.
Great questions. As I mentioned, best of luck with your professional development. Feel free to, get some mentorship on our community at discord.maximustribe.com. Feel free to follow up, whether on the Discord or a follow-up chat in terms of if you find a pattern between, your stress levels and your functioning as well.
And just to make sure this is clear, you think it's unlikely that this is related to smoking marijuana and then stopping?
It's hard to speculate. It can be. Like, some people do have...
That's my main hypothesis.
It could be. I mean, some people do have some sort of... marijuana doesn't have the same sort of physiological withdrawal as other sort of harder sort of drugs, but heavy, it depends on the amount of use. Heavy smokers...
Not heavy.
Yeah.
Twice a week.
Some people do report some mild sort of withdrawal symptoms. Probably more psychological withdrawal. I mean, you are activating your endocannabinoid receptors. You're sort of used to simulating them and you stop, may have effects. I don't think this is well studied or well characterized, but I mean, you should, like I said, do a natural experiment with yourself. Like, in the weeks that you use versus the weeks that you don't use, obviously not encouraging use, but you're going to do what you're going to do anyway. Notice if that the association between that and some of the symptoms that you're experiencing. And if there are, obviously, then you got to make that cost benefit. I mean, people absolutely notice, for instance, the association with drinking an ED, right? There's the literally the term whiskey dick is not a clinical term, but people understand what that is because it's clearly not good for sexual function. So now that doesn't stop people from drinking, but you have to make that cost benefit, or at least when you do drink, probably it's wise to be very moderate in terms of your drinking if you plan on having sexual activity later and you want to perform. So, you got to kind of find, everyone has their different tolerance levels. Some people, it doesn't affect them very much. Some people, it affects them quite a bit. We have a lot of individual variability in terms of our sensitivity to pharmacology. And so that's why I can give you like hypotheticals, but you have to kind of test stuff for yourself, figure out what's true for you, and also what dosages are true for you. It's not just alcohol, marijuana, stress. Oftentimes we say in pharmacology, the dose makes the poison. Meaning you could be fine at one drink, one smoke, or a moderate amount of stress. But once it kicks high, multiple use, multiple drinks, it may function totally differently in terms of how it affects your brain and how it affects your function. So you kind of have to figure out your sort of sweet spot for yourself and what you can tolerate and what cost benefit is beneficial for you.
Yeah, that's definitely extremely interesting to hear. If I had to guess, for me at least, observing myself, it would not be right after. It would be if I've been maybe smoking for, a couple of weeks and then I just stop cold turkey.
Yeah. So, any sort of sudden changes, that's why the first thing I ask people when they notice any sort of symptoms, I'm like, are you doing anything differently, right? Or are you making any changes? It is quite plausible that when you suddenly sort of change any sort of, whether it's a health behavior routine, medication supplement, or substance, it is quite possible. So, yeah, test that for yourself, see how it goes. But obviously, long-term, the two things that stand out to me about what you said is you have high amounts of stress and you smoke marijuana regularly. Obviously, probably not a coincidence. Most people obviously smoke in order to cope with their stress. It's not a great coping mechanism, though, in the sense that it obviously temporarily numbs, your stress levels, But obviously the moment that you, you know, you're back and sober, your stress levels are right there again. So, you know, it's a temporary alleviation or avoidance behavior, as we'd say in psychology. So that's why I'm a big fan of ACT. It's called Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. It's literally the therapy that I train the residents in and that I practice myself. There's a lot of good resources on it. If you want an interesting like primer or introduction to it, there's a great book. It's called The Happiness Trap. It's written by a colleague of mine, Dr. Russ Harris. It's a great introduction to ACT philosophy. And it actually makes a very interesting contrarian argument that instead of avoiding anxiety or stress, we should actually be leaning into it. And the reason that Americans are so unhappy is because we're obsessed with happiness and feeling good all the time. The point of life is not to feel good, avoid pain, and be right. It's to be present, open up, and to do what matters. That's really ACT in a nutshell. So I think it'd be very helpful, like if there's like one bit of life advice that I think applies to any young person that I'm talking to, it's you got to learn helpful, more mature coping mechanisms to deal with the inevitable stress and suffering that's endemic in life. And I think ACT is a really, really helpful, almost like operating system, since you're going to become a software engineer, to be able to navigate, you know, the challenges that you're inevitably going to face.
That's awesome. All right, so I wrote that down, the happiness track, and you know, the treating it like a log, I think, is going to be very interesting too. You know, I'll just write everything down. It'll definitely give me more insight into everything. So yeah, it all sounds good. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and one last recommendation. You know, you may want to consider actually like working with a psychologist and you know, doing therapy. The book is a great introduction to the philosophy, but therapy is really a relationship, and I recommend everyone get therapy, quite frankly. You know, it's especially when you're dealing with stuff like this, you want to work with someone who like reviews those logs with you. You want to someone that can help you navigate the challenges of obviously finding, you know, meaningful work as you're facing, and just like those life stressors. And over time, obviously, you want to develop those coping mechanisms in a way that's more mature, that's healthier, doesn't rely on substances obviously as much. So therapy can be very, very life-changing. And you know, 80% of people who go to therapy report that they're better off for it. It works pretty well most of the time. Most of the time, in fact, people that I talk to wish that they had done it sooner in life. You know, they typically, unfortunately, most people only go to therapy when it's really bad, things are going terrible. And that's really hard sometimes when to dig yourself out of when you're like seriously depressed. The best time, in fact, is when things are going well, I would argue, or you're mildly struggling with stuff, because, you know, you at least have a little bit more of the wherewithal to be able to practice some of the things when, you know, you're able to handle it. So consider that as something to do. Awesome. Thank you for your questions. If there's other folks with questions, I see RL on Twitter. I see Ann on Clubhouse. If anyone else wants to raise their hand and ask a question, feel free to do so. I'll bring you up on the stage. You want to ask the questions from our YouTube audience?
We had a question from Discord. Hey, Dr. Kemp, you mentioned high intensity training with Dorian Yates. I like to follow the program called Body by Science by Dr. Doug McGuff, which focuses on a very slow 10 seconds lift, 10 seconds lower motions for time under tension, which is very exhausting and focuses on muscle failure. For no more than half an hour, at most twice a week. Would this be a good example of an efficient workout, and would other kinds of supplemental activity help optimize our overall health without overstressing our muscles?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not familiar with that particular program, but I do understand the principle that's behind it, which is time under tension. So for the listeners that are listening, it's a really important principle of doing strength training that it's not just about the amount of weight that you lift. You know, obviously there's a benefit to lifting heavy weights if you're trying to increase strength, right? Like you're being a power lifter. But most people aren't competing in powerlifting. Most people are just trying to strengthen their muscles and their bones and obviously just be healthy. So the principle is it's not just like banging out reps as fast as possible. It's the amount of time under tension. Your muscles need tension or resistance, and the amount of time that is actually the more important thing. So in the example that you brought up, if you're spending 10 seconds on the concentric or the lifting portion, and then 10 seconds on the eccentric or the part where you're kind of lifting the weight back down, that's 20 seconds time under tension, and you're stimulating the muscle, even if you're going really slow. So it is a useful principle, and it actually can work. The benefit of that kind of program is you can use lighter weights, because obviously like lifting one rep taking 20 seconds is pretty exhausting, right? Because you're holding it up that whole time. Like imagine if you're just like doing nothing, for most people grabbing a bar and hanging from a bar for 20 seconds is pretty exhausting. It exhausts your fingers, your grip strength, your forearms, all that good stuff. So it can actually be very effective without putting a lot of strain on your joints if you're not trying to, you know, do the opposite of powerlifting. Now, one variation that I kind of prefer, I do think that power is important, especially if you're doing any sort of athletic or sports performance. You're obviously not moving slowly if you're doing a sport. And so there's two different ways of doing this. One way of doing this is you want to do the concentric portion very quickly, right? So imagine you're doing a bench press. You want to lift it up while maintaining control and while maintaining proper form quickly. And so it's kind of like that burst or that power when you lift the weight. And then you do the eccentric portion slowly, right? So you're lowering it down as slow as possible. So you're typically taking 1 to 2 seconds to lift up, and then 10 seconds, or let's say 5 seconds, I would say, is a little easier to do, to lift down. And so you're doing different amounts for the concentric and eccentric phase. And you kind of get the best of both worlds that way in terms of you're developing power, which is generalizable to sports performance on the concentric, and you're building muscle through the eccentric portion and the tiny micro tears that are happening in the fibers. A different variation of that, which you'll see in some programs, is you do those on different days. So you could have a power day where you cut the weight in half in terms of the weight, and you focus on fast movements. And then on other days, you can lift heavier weights at a slower pace. And varying that on different days allows you to kind of get variety in your weightlifting routine. So that's another way of essentially doing that principle. But you know, if you talk to and look at the bodybuilders, in fact, that have long careers, the ones that lifted more powerlifting style, and this is an association, but like Ronnie Coleman would be a good example, has had double hip replacement surgery, like lifting super heavy weights. While you look at guys like Jay Cutler, who is, but Jay Cutler, you know, publicly said, I have no idea what my bench press max is. I don't ever do a one rep PR. I do like 10 sets of 10 reps of bench. And that way, because you're lifting lighter weights, because you're focusing on that 8 to 12 rep range, you're less likely to injure yourself because you're putting less strain on your, muscles, tendons, and joints. So I think, you know, focusing more on form, quality, time under tension, as you put it, is absolutely a great, smart, and safe way of doing weightlifting. The last thing I would say is just listen to your body. You know, there's a difference as an athlete learns between good and bad pain. There's a normal, like, good pain of, like, normal fatigue, you know, muscular strain. If you watch Dorian Yates, they kind of, like, go to failure, basically, at the end of, even though they're only doing one set of each exercise, but they're going all the way, and they can't possibly lift the bar anymore. That's good pain, as long as it's done in a safe way and it's not causing an injury, versus if you're kind of burnt out, you're caught, you know, your form is getting off, you have nagging kind of pain even after you lift. That's what you really want to avoid, especially if you want to have a long, you know, career even as an amateur weightlifter. Lacey, I see you're up on the Clubhouse audience. You have a question?
Interesting. Absolutely. So I guess I had a couple questions. Why would a 46-year-old man need anastrozole?
Anastrozole is an aromatase inhibitor. So an aromatase inhibitor is a prescription pharmaceutical drug that basically blocks the conversion between testosterone and estradiol. So as I mentioned, estradiol or estrogen comes from or is derived from testosterone. And so if you block the aromatase enzyme, which is what anastrozole does, it basically lowers estrogen or estradiol and it increases testosterone. So it is, there's a number of reasons. I can't speculate why someone's taking any particular drug, but there's a couple plausible reasons why it could be taken. So anastrozole actually, I believe, is more commonly used in women. It's a drug that's used for the treatment of breast cancer or estrogen-dependent cancers. So if estrogen is sort of fueling that cancer, reducing estrogen or estradiol is obviously a helpful way of treating the cancer or preventing tumor growth. That's what it's most commonly used for. But in men, let's say a guy has very high estradiol levels, whether, let's say, due to obesity, it could be helpful for that person to try to lower their estradiol levels, increase their testosterone levels. Now, anastrozole is not typically used as a testosterone booster. We actually don't use it, for instance, in Maximus. The reason for that, it does work, right? It increases testosterone, but the problem is it lowers estrogen and estradiol quite dramatically. And so even though these guys' levels of testosterone is quite high, they feel terrible, right? There's, in fact, a published research study that used a stronger aromatase inhibitor called letrozole, which is stronger than anastrozole. Same family of chemicals, though. It can double, if not, like, I don't know, in some cases, more increased testosterone levels. But it caused erectile dysfunction in 50% of the guys. And so it's kind of confusing. You're like, well, shouldn't erectile function be better in guys who have higher testosterone? Generally speaking, yes. But on an aromatase inhibitor, it's not true, because estradiol is actually necessary in men for good libido and erectile function. The way I kind of describe estrogen in men is it's kind of like a Goldilocks zone. You don't want it to be too low. You don't want it to be too high. If it's too low, you get messed up sexual function. If it's too high, you also get messed up sexual function. And so for most men, taking an aromatase inhibitor like anastrozole didn't give them symptomatic relief for the most part, unless they're very high in the first place. In that case, it'll maybe take them from high to normal. While most guys, if they're sort of healthy, it's just going to take them from normal to below normal, and you're not going to feel very good. And so that's why it's generally not indicated. Second reason is if someone is taking testosterone replacement therapy or is using anabolic steroids that convert to estradiol, those two compounds, when they're taken externally, can increase the conversion to estradiol. So as opposed to a sort of a medical reason that you have high estradiol, meaning obesity, if you're taking drugs that increase your estradiol levels, commonly anastrozole is used as an adjunctive therapy that's added to the TRT protocol, for instance. Or if you're illegally using steroids, it can be used to reduce the amount of estradiol. So a lot of guys or their doctors will use it to almost dial in or fine tune, if you will, their estradiol levels because they're taking a drug or a compound that may be increasing it. So the long answer to your question is the reason typically that males will take it is for estrogen control, but you can't really know why they're doing that. It could be for genetic reasons, could be obesity, could be TRT, could be steroids, could be lots of different reasons that people are taking it. So you can't conclusively say, but generally it's an estrogen control agent. And sometimes it can be very helpful for folks if their estrogen is out of control. But for most guys, it's not really a helpful medication as a standalone, I would say, type of medication.
Cool. Thanks so much for your insight. I don't know if you have time for one more question.
Sure.
Does ADHD affect hormones? I'm a psychologist, and a lot of my students have ADHD, so I'm just curious to know if it affects hormones.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not sure when you use the word effect, like there's a causality that's been established. Now, there may be an association between folks who have ADHD and other hormonal issues, right? That's actually a great question. I actually don't know the answer to that question. And I'm actually going to look it up after. Like, I'm curious, for instance, if folks with diagnosed ADHD have different testosterone levels than folks who do not. Now, that doesn't establish causality, as I mentioned. It could be that there's a third factor to that. Like, for instance, people with ADHD tend to smoke more because they tend to self-medicate, essentially, in terms of preferring to use stimulants like nicotine or obviously prescription stimulants as well. And that may influence testosterone levels. So it's unclear why. Is it because of the ADHD, or is it because of compensatory behavior that people are doing when they have ADHD? That is unclear, but it's a great question, and I'll look it up after. I'm not familiar with any literature that shows that, like, for instance, folks with ADHD have different levels, but I'm sure there's probably been some associational or epidemiological research that could clarify that.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Other folks with questions?
C. Marie, how are you, Dr. Cam?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Also, my question, I'm not sure if this is the right forum. I have a question about kidney function, hypertension, insulin resistance, keto diet, and weight training, and how that all ties together. Recently, I'm following the keto diet for 2 years. Mm-hmm. I'm physically active, bike riding, walking. I've been diagnosed with insulin resistance, although mm-hmm. my glucoses are normal and my A1C is 4.9. I've been following my glucoses every day, almost like a continuous glucose monitoring to mm-hmm. see what affects it what in my diet, because I've stalled on weight loss with keto. Yeah. And an article came across my desk today, and it had to do with GFR. And GFR typically was reported as greater than 60, and now they actually give you a number. Mm-hmm. And my number was 62.4, which is indicative of chronic kidney disease, and it kind of took me aback. And I'm just wondering, what is the best exercise routine and diet? I have an appointment with my primary care coming up. I brought it to their attention. What's the best diet and exercise to follow for possible, because keto isn't going to be an option now because it's high protein, with insulin resistance, and is weight training okay?
Yeah. Do you know why or what constituted your diagnosis of insulin resistance? Was before you were on keto, for instance, were your blood, did you have a blood test that?
My fasting glucoses were trending high.
I see.
So they were trending still at 100 and within normal range, but they were trending high.
Right. So yeah. So what you're bringing up is, it sounds like you're kind of, we're in the pre-diabetes range. Typically when you're fasting, plasma glucose is between 100 and 125. You're considered to have pre-diabetes, which is the formal medical condition, which is caused by insulin resistance. It sounds like you've done a phenomenal job in terms of your lifestyle and your diet in terms of reducing your glucose levels. Sounds like it's regressed essentially to the normal glycemic range, and your A1C is fantastic if it's below 5. Typically, it's like, above 5.7 starts to constitute sort of worry. So it sounds like you've done a good job in terms of managing your levels due to lifestyle, but now you mentioned obviously this sort of like GFR or EGFR's issue in terms of your kidney function. So that's obviously something you got to bring up with your doctor and your specialist. One, like reference labs are different in terms of, like for instance, like if you're African American or not, like the interpretation of that value is different, and also different labs have different reference ranges. Generally speaking, I'm not providing medical advice. The range that you're, mentioning is like below sort of optimal or sort of super healthy sort of levels. Now, I don't know if that's warrants concern. That's really up to your provider to kind of diagnose and kind of figure out what's going on, like what's the cause of that, and what would be the medically appropriate treatment. To your point, it is common that, you know, if you're not sort of processing, if you have sort of kidney issues, you probably need to be a little bit more careful about your diet in terms of protein consumption, as you're mentioning. So yeah, you may need to modify your diet, but that's kind of up to your provider in terms of the interpretation of what's going on there. And then obviously see whatever you're doing, is it changing your levels or not? Like, are they staying static over time? Are they improving when you change your diet? Because obviously you want to maintain, healthy kidney function. Generally speaking, I think the research literature does support the fact that ketogenic diets are the best diet for people on the diabetes spectrum, as you mentioned. But it's not the only diet that works. So even though it is very helpful, and that's in fact all the research that I did at Omada Health in terms of getting people to reduce their blood glucose levels, reduce their A1C levels, that assumes that you're not causing, any other issues or, contraindications that would move that fact. You can still follow a lower carbohydrate diet. That's not necessarily ketogenic. It's not putting you into ketosis. That can still do really great for controlling your blood sugar levels. Like, in fact, the philosophy of Atkins, which is almost like, the precursor to keto, was you do keto for a few weeks, and then you slowly start reintroducing carbohydrates back to a level that maintains your weight. So, and that's going to be different for every person. Someone who, needs stricter control, maybe that's 50 grams of carbs. For an otherwise healthy guy who's like lifting a lot of weights or super physically active, you know, I have a colleague, JT, who I think he can consume like 100 plus grams of carbs and still be in ketosis because he works out so much. But the point is, you know, you may find your individual carbohydrate tolerance, and that may not be ketogenic. That still maintains, you know, good blood sugar levels and maintains your weight at a level that is healthy for you. It may be the same thing for your protein. Now, this is, I'm not providing medical advice, this is speculation. You might have to find what's the appropriate amount. Obviously, protein is still the most critical macronutrient and is critical for your, you know, muscle and bones. So you can't avoid it altogether, but you might need to find what's an appropriate amount that's right for you, given what may be going on in terms of your kidneys. That I would just really work really closely with your doctor to figure out, like I said, what's causing that level in the first place. Is it a correct reading? Do you need to retest? And what's the underlying cause of that? If you need to work with a nephrologist to kind of figure out what's going on in the kidney front, and then obviously follow their advice, monitor, and see how that affects you over time. But I think in your case, because you're bringing up something that's a little bit more complicated, you're going to have to really work with some professionals and do a little bit of experimentation under their guidance and supervision to find out what works for you.
Great, thank you. The continuous glucose monitoring has been very helpful because foods that you would assume would be okay aren't always okay for me.
Right.
And so it's been helpful in determining what I can and cannot eat.
What were some interesting things from using a CGM? I'm curious.
One is how hydration affects your glucose, your levels, mm-hmm. and also how stress affects your glucose levels. And exercises too. You know, I although it's pretty common sense, you know, as you're working out, your glucose levels increase. And I'm thinking, I'm working out, why are these going up? But it is supposed to, because you're releasing, to meet your energy needs. Right. And so that was, you know, it's common sense, but at the time I wasn't thinking that. But I was surprised to see how hydration and stress.
Presumably that when you're dehydrated and have greater stress, your blood sugar levels go up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And just rehydrating, like with 40 ounces of water, made a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great insight. And one of the things people find also on keto tends to increase cortisol levels, even though although it's great for, you know, blood sugar control. If you're very like if you're in deep, very low carbohydrate type of ketosis, it can jack up cortisol levels. And so it's important for folks to make sure that if you are doing keto, to also make sure that your minerals are dialed in. Supplementing with a little bit of sodium, assuming you're not hypertensive, making sure that you're getting enough potassium from food, supplemental magnesium. Those are like the three most common in addition to calcium that you naturally get from if you're consuming dairy. Really help people feel better on ketogenic diets and they don't get the so-called keto flu type of symptoms. Interestingly, salt and cortisol also have a relationship. If you're sweating a lot and you're losing a lot of sodium in your salt, because obviously your sweat is very salty, people sometimes make sure they try to get a little extra sodium level. So there's a old like runner's lore that like people who run a lot and they get cramps, for instance, they drink pickle juice. And the reason for that is, you know, obviously pickle juice is very salty and high in sodium. It alleviates their cramps, makes them feel a lot better. And this is an interesting trick, by the way, that even if you're not like, you know, pre-diabetic, if you find yourself waking up at night, like in the middle of the night, and, you know, you're waking up kind of feeling stressed, heart is kind of racing, and it's not because of a nightmare or anything like that, and you find yourself sweaty, because some people obviously sweat a lot when they sleep, whether it's, you know, due to their environment or their metabolism, drinking a little bit of salt water, pickle juice, you know, anything that's sort of salty, a pickle, can actually lower cortisol levels and help people fall back asleep. It's an interesting little trick, but it does actually help, and I've tried it myself sometimes, and it does seem to work really well.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Great question. I think we have time for maybe one more question before we hit 7 o'clock. You want it? Yeah, go ahead. Floor is yours.
I'm brand new to Clubhouse, so thank you for giving me a chance to ask a question. But
sure.
I kind of have a collection of issues from the last, you know, 10, 15 years. And right now I have Hashimoto's, PCOS, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease,
mm-hmm.
and Sjögren's syndrome. and my medical team is having a hell of a time kind of dialing in on helping me with that. Yeah. It seems like every time I make progress in one direction, it causes the scale to tip in another direction, and I'm just constantly chasing my tail. Now, what they kind of keep telling me is just keep on doing what you're doing, but I'm not seeing results.
Mm-hmm.
I gain weight really easily, and it usually will happen like once a year. I'll gain something like 30 or 40 pounds, and then I can never go backwards on it. And my concern is, given the specifics of my health issues, like PCOS, the fatty liver disease, one of the first things they always recommend is lose weight.
Right.
And I'm at a point where I can't do that, and I'm not making progress. So I was wondering if you just, and I guess as background, I do weightlifting. Mm-hmm. Every practitioner I work with kind of has a different idea of like how extreme I should be with that. So right now I'm more between like a training to fatigue on 3 times a week,
mm-hmm.
and I incorporate cardio in that. And as far as diet goes, it's mostly plant-based, and I do get about 100 grams of protein, so it's not strictly plant-based, but mm-hmm. no alcohol and very limited sugar intake. So yeah. I was wondering if you had any ideas on what I could do to see progress or just a direction you could point me in.
Yeah, I mean, you're bringing up, I mean, you have multiple medical comorbidities that are probably, in fact, interacting with one another. So I don't think there's, unfortunately, any like generic advice that I could apply to your case, but I do have some thoughts that could be helpful. It's frustrating, and I hear your pain in the sense of like generally like losing excess body fat is helpful for treating any kind of, especially like any metabolic condition. But if your thyroid and your hormones are messed up, that obviously inhibits it. So you're kind of in this chicken and the egg problem that kind of falls, you know, gets you to be where you're at right now. So it is tricky. That's why like probably like generic advice is not going to be applicable to you, in that, you know, the best thing I would say is just you got to find really, really good practitioners that are familiar with your particular conditions to work with, because there's probably idiosyncrasies. There may be stuff that just above and beyond sort of standard diet advice, like, you know, dialing in thyroid medications that are going to make probably a bigger difference than even the behavioral stuff, right? Because if your thyroid, you know, your hypothyroid or you got Hashimoto's, I believe you said, it's going to significantly impair, you know, your ability to do what you need to do. So that's like the first and foremost is, you know, when you're dealing with really complex medical cases, you know, as best as you can, you know, you may need to like evolve over time your care team, and find the right people, see what sort of works. But it is, I understand the challenge, and I know it's frustrating because maybe they don't even know what to do, because, you know, this is not a textbook sort of case, especially when you got multiple stuff going on. So it may take a little bit of time to kind of find the right people to work with. And also it probably takes a little bit of patience, in that in reality, and this is like my clinical experience, whenever I'm dealing with really complex cases, it takes a lot of time, right? It's not, even though everyone wants to be better immediately, the reality is it's going to probably be months, if not years, of trial and error to kind of figure out what works. So I know it's not probably what you want to hear, but I also think like realistic expectation setting is really important. But also it helps kind of alleviate, you know, people becoming too frustrated and burnt out when they're, you know, expecting more than what's realistic. Second thing, in terms of the weightlifting, I think it's fantastic that you're actually doing weightlifting and that you're being very active about it. You know, a lot of folks obviously with, you know, chronic medical conditions, you know, and they're very symptomatic, aren't able to do that. So I think that's a huge positive and strength that you have going. So, you know, I don't know if there's any particular contraindications with the medical conditions that you mentioned, you know, with weightlifting, but I think this is where, you know, listening to your body and also tracking, just like the first caller that we had, is going to be really important, in the sense that, you know, you kind of have to figure out what works for you. And so is 3 days a week the right amount versus, let's say, a 5-day-a-week, you know, workout? I generally, for instance, I'm not talking about you in particular, but in general advice, actually encourage people, you know, 3 days a week I think is great because it's realistic in terms of consistency. If I find like I'm working with clients that are more motivated and they're willing to go to the gym more often, 5 days a week produces better results in terms of hypertrophy because you're just putting in more volume. Right. And we know like one of the variables that increases muscular mass, if that's your goal, is just putting in more volume. And so that, and in some ways, the daily consistency of going to the gym Monday through Friday, for some folks who are, you know, they like doing that, is fantastic. There's other clients I work with, if I can get them to go to the gym once a week, that's all I can ever ask for, because they just don't like lifting weights. They prefer to do more outdoor activities, biking, running, et cetera. And I'm like, great, do whatever exercise that gets you to do it consistently. I always say the same thing about diet. The best diet is honestly the one that you can stick to long term. I can tell you theoretically about what are better diets, but one thing that may be specific to you that I would explore is you may want to do a little bit of exploration and experimentation on whether the plant-based diet that you're working with is optimal versus a little bit more of an animal-based diet. I'm like not speaking to your specific condition and medical, you know, conditions, but in general, I may very much make a strong argument that animal-based diets are the natural human diet. If you look at the anthropological research, you know, the majority of hunter-gatherer cultures essentially eat a majority of their calories from animals. It's very rare that there are like more plant-heavy or plant-based societies. In fact, there's not a single one that's ever been vegan because it 100% causes nutritional deficiencies. So unfortunately, there's been a very big propaganda push lately with some unfortunate doctors and organizations that push plant-based as being superior to health. I think it's quite frankly wrong. If there's a book that I recommend by Dr. Catherine Sheehan, it's called, now I forgot the name of the book. I'm going to look this up real quick. But she talks actually about why ancestral diets are superior. And I think it's actually pretty convincing. So you may want to experiment with that and just see if a more animal-based diet may be helpful in terms of what your symptoms are and going on. Doesn't mean you need to eat all meat. I don't advocate carnivore diets where they're eating 100% meat. But for instance, if you look at like the ancestral diets of indigenous Native Americans, 85% of their calories actually came from animals. And they still, of course, ate a wide variety of plants. But they're not eating a lot of the vegetables. In fact, this is my contrarian opinion. I think vegetables are actually very overrated. Hunter-gatherers don't actually eat a lot of green leafy vegetables. And that's because plants have a lot of anti-nutrients. Plants can't run away from you, and so they have chemical defenses that discourage you from eating them. Animals, of course, can run away. And so, we actually metabolize and process animal-based foods much better, in fact, than most plant-based foods. Most of the plants, in fact, the hunter-gatherers eat are fruits, but they're ancestral fruits. They're more like berries, for instance. Strawberries, blueberries, blackberries are closer to kind of what are ancestral fruits, not like super sugary, pineapples and stuff that probably no one, sort of ate. And tubers, meaning things that grow below the ground. Think of like turnips, carrots, radishes, sweet potatoes, those kinds of things. So they're mostly eating tubers, berries. Like African tribes eat a plant called baobab. I'm a big fan of. It's a very unique fruit because it's basically 50% fiber. It's very low in sugar, very high in those minerals that I mentioned, potassium, magnesium, calcium. And it's an ancestral. They haven't bred it. It's never been farmed. They haven't modified it like we have, like giant strawberries that we have that look nothing like a wild strawberry. So you may want to consider sort of exploring a more animal-based diet. That's my personal opinion, but I think it's backed up by, a lot of good literature as well. But listen, in the end, you got to kind of figure out what works for you. And like I said, work with a good care team. And the last and final recommendation is, when you're dealing with a lot of chronic medical conditions, finding good support, I think, is really critical. There's a lot of, if you're not already connected with patient support groups, there's great websites and communities like Patients Like Me that are online in addition to individual ones. The one thing I'd be wary of, there's a lot of Facebook groups out there, and the quality just varies a lot. There's a lot of quite frankly, wackos out there that promote very extreme non-evidence-based practices, crazy fasting and other routines to treat, conditions. And I quite frankly think they take advantage of folks, because a lot of folks like you who are at their wit's end, they're not being helped enough by the mainstream medical establishment. You look to alternative treatments, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that. There may be some basis, but really it's not a replacement for medical care. And I really do believe in following the science. So if you are joining an online community patient group, make sure that it's one that's like rigorous, scientific, and it's not kind of delving too far off into the alternative realm that gets you to do stuff that it may actually hurt your conditions more than it helps. So I hope there's a little bit of glimmer of helpfulness in what you're dealing with. But I wish you the absolute best, and I know it's not easy to deal with.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for your question. We're over time today. Thank you everyone who's joined us on Twitter, Discord, Clubhouse, YouTube. If you have any questions that I didn't answer, we do this show every single week, Thursdays at 6 o'clock Pacific. Join us on our Discord at discord.maximustribe.com. If you type in any question there, Victor, our esteemed radio host and support, will save it for the next week. And if you're interested in what you're doing in terms of hormone optimization and you're a guy based in the United States, we serve 13 U.S. states right now. You can check us out at maximustribe.com that we can safely and effectively double your testosterone levels. All right, everyone, have a wonderful rest of your Thursday. Wish you the best in continuing to kick butt on your New Year's resolutions, and I'll catch you all next week.